Good morning and welcome to our meeting. It is 9:00 on November 7th, 2023, and time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Rebecca Wolf, President of the Commission. We have here today Commissioner Sid Lowman, Vice President, Commissioner Tony Olson, Secretary, John Harlow, CEO, General Manager, Colin Willenbrock, General Counsel, Melissa Collins, Commissioner and Executive Services Director, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, and Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or other electronic devices. This session is for the Board and CEO, General Manager, to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. I will now turn the meeting over to CEO, General Manager, John Harlow, who will facilitate the discussion. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Commissioners. Lots of good stuff on the agenda, both the morning and afternoon session, so we'll get right at it. First up, media update, and Aaron Sweeney. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Commissioners. Aaron Sweeney, PRN Media Liaison. Here to talk to you about some of the great stuff going on in the news lately. Jump right into it. We got some great news recently about a grant that we received. So we jumped right into getting the press release out. Kelly worked with John Heeb and Susie Oversby on some local coverage on Northwest Public Broadcasting. KNKX also picked it up. Local newspapers picked it up. I think we're working on a story with the Herald right now. Also, trade publications, TND World, APPA, NWPPA all picked it up. And this is really big news. It's a really big deal, and I don't think this is the end of the coverage for this.
It was also mentioned at Public Power Council and PNUG, Energy Northwest, all these association meetings are all just.
Yeah, I think it's a really big thing for us. I think it's going to be able to really speed up some of the grid reliability projects we want to do. And so getting that message out was really important for us.
And just really quick, we will have John Heeb immediately after Aaron wraps up the media. John Heeb is going to come on and just give a little bit more details on.
Oh, good. Great.
Tell us what we want.
Yes, tell us what we want.
Maybe the information is in that story, but who were the staff people who were the people who worked on it?
There was a number. There's so many. I think John will be able to go into that and into greater detail for sure.
Yeah.
We've had some really good stories on fish lately. A lot of the projects we've been working on, on the Sultan River, we had a nice story. Kelly worked with Keith Binkley, got out there with a Herald reporter talking about the side channel restoration projects we've been doing out there. And also the Wood Key Creek's trestle that was taken down. That was kind of a really hindering fish in Woods Creek that was taken down. We funded that project and Herald did a really nice story on that as well. So good to get those stories out there, let our customers know that we continue to do a lot of work for fish. Potpourri, just a bunch of stuff here. Our Powering Life columns recently in the Herald. October, we did preparing for outages, getting our customers ready. Obviously going into last year, into November, we had that big storm. We just want to make sure our customers are prepared and ready for all that. And we've had some major improvements to our outage map, which I'll get into in a minute. That was also mentioned. And then in November, the energy storage column really focused on how energy storage is critical for us, meeting clean energy mandates, meeting reliability goals that we have. That's what we focused on in October. These are wrong. September was preparing for outages. October was energy storage, my fault. And then Power Talks is our presentation that we give to customers every other month. We just recently did our November one on the 2nd, and that was again focusing on power outages. We had Scott Parker talk about creating an emergency kit, getting prepared for outages. We had Carlos Tostada come on and talk about generator safety and if a generator is right for you, what the steps should you take. And then we had Cassidy Warren come on and talk about the improvements we've made to the outage map. And we also had APPA did a podcast, and they talked about utility podcasts, and they included Power Talks in there, and just kind of the uniqueness of Power Talks and how we're inviting customers in to ask questions and be a part. Usually podcasts are generally one direction. We're kind of doing a two-directional one.
So what's our outreach to this in terms of informing people?
So we do a lot of marketing of Power Talks. It's one of those ones where the subject generally drives the interest. So solar and EVs were very popular. Some of the other ones, not so much, but we do a lot of marketing around it. We're going to try to up that next year by reaching out to some of our community partners and driving that message further.
Yeah, I think it would be, it's a good opportunity for those customers that are interested.
For sure.
To learn a little bit more about the agenda.
Yeah, generally we get about 50 to 100 folks to come in.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay.
And the ones that come in actually are really engaged. They ask a lot of questions and are really curious about stuff.
So this is timely because on my way down to Portland and back last week, I caught up on my podcast. I listened to the APP podcast and I got to listen to Kelly Stickney, and she did a wonderful job on the podcast.
Yeah.
And so then I decided, well, I'll listen to Power Talks. Of course, it's video, but I didn't watch the video. I just listened to them. And it's really nice. And I encourage both of you to go on the website, because the neat thing is it's mostly information we've heard. But it's great to have so many questions from customers and to understand what our customers are interested in. So I really enjoyed the one, and you do a great job with it, the two gentlemen that had built, carbon neutral homes.
Yes.
And that was a fascinating conversation about what they went through.
Yeah, we had a lot of questions for
them. Yeah, that was
battery storage and solar.
Yeah. Evolving, and I haven't caught the new one lately. I knew they were happening, I just didn't realize they were recorded and available online.
Yeah. Yeah, we record them and send them out.
Are they archived that we can?
They are.
Okay, great.
So if you go to snowpeg.com/powertalks, they're all there.
Great.
Anyway, good work.
And then just some press releases. We just did our Run for Warmth press release where we talked about raising $4,000 for Project Pride. Very excited about that. We also partnered with Sultan School District on an evacuation drill. So we sent that press release out recently, picked up some media coverage. And then, like I mentioned earlier, we've done a lot of upgrading to our outage map. So we sent out a press release last week talking about. And then one that's not on here that just went out last week was one on scams. We're seeing a little bit of an uptick in scams connected to our Connect Up project. So we wanted to get out in front of that and let our customers know. We've got information on the website. We're putting information in the wire and all that.
I was wondering about the evacuation drill. How does PUD fit into schools doing the evacuation drills?
Well, so we are there kind of overseeing. Obviously, it's our dam, so we're helping the city of Sultan put on the drill, and the school district's putting on the drill. And we're just there as kind of informational experts.
Oh, so it's related.
I'm sorry, I apologize.
No, I was just going to say it's related to the dam.
It is, yes. It's related to Kalmbach Dam, so it's an evacuation drill.
Okay, I was just wondering.
Yeah, if that burst, Sultan would take that burst. Sultan is in the direct line.
Well, yeah.
Well, our dam is very safe.
Oh, no. There used to be, I thought, some kind of a contractual agreement.
I think there's a contractual agreement for the tabletop exercise drilling.
Okay.
This is a little bit different. This was the school district trying to make sure that if there is something, that school, though some of those schools are in the floodplain, they get the kids up, they walk them up, and they do that. So it's just making sure that they know, that they're aware of what's going on, and if they ever hear those sirens, they know what to do.
Oh, the sirens are still there.
I believe so, yes.
So I've heard about school districts doing this if they live near Carnation, some of the areas from the Snoqualmie.
I believe that's the Toll Dam.
The Toll?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And so very similar. So a lot of the same kind of evacuations.
I was pleased to see that I think at least three or four local outlets picked up a story about the scammers. So
yeah,
it's really an important message to get out, because Connect Up is such a one-off thing to everything we do.
It is.
I could potentially see how people might get confused or something when someone comes to their door.
Yeah, and they're going up. They're not really acting like PUD employees, but they're talking about our PUD projects, and our fear is that they are doing they're up to no good, right? And
right.
So we want to make sure customers know these are not our people. Right. Here's how you can tell our people. There's a badge. They'll be driving a PUD vehicle. It's just reminding them that, what to look for, and if you have any concerns, to call us.
Good work.
Locations, the November Wire just hitting mailboxes now. We really focused on our servicemen, our first responders, the folks who go out, and they are out there right at this time of year, in the dark, bad weather, and they're the ones that are doing a lot of the work. Mike Black, shout out to him for being willing to chat with me and do a story and kind of a profile on him. He was great.
This was one of the best, I thought.
Yeah, it's nice to get our people's faces out there and really let people know what our folks do, especially during storm season. And also, he really said, can you put a safety note in there about folks driving near us when we're out there? They get a lot of people driving fast, dangerous. So I said, sure, of course, we can get that out there. And we also mentioned the BPA pass-through and some of, again, our outage map improvements. We're really trying to hammer that home. And then finally, just wanted to put this on the website, up on the website, some information. It's been a year since we have had our new website. Wendy Paris and team have done an amazing job on the website. I think we had about 88,000 visitors to our website last month. Most of them going to the homepage, going to My Snowbud, looking at bills, doing things like that. But there's a lot of information on there. I'll really try to get out and inform customers.
Significant chunk of me going to the outage map.
But what is you
7,000? Yeah, I'm just,
you mean by yourself?
Well, you probably have a hotline.
Yeah, probably.
You know, there's a button on your phone, John.
Yeah.
Take that right to it.
Yes. But that still counts.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
That's it for me. Any questions?
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Awesome job. Thank you. So as promised, we have John Heeb, who is online, to give you a little more of the update on DOE GRIP grant. John, are you on?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Perfect. Thank you for the intro, John. Cat's out of the bag a little bit here, but I'm here to talk about the Snowpud GRIP grant. I'm John Heeb, principal engineer in the System Planning and Protection Department, and I really wish I was there, but I had already booked this travel to a conference in Florida. So hopefully.
Apologize.
So would you give us the name for the acronym GRIP?
Yeah, it's Grid Resilience and Innovation Partnerships is what GRIP stands for. As you may recall, back in March, Susie Oversby and I shared information about this Snow Smart project, which stands for Snohomish PUD's Secure, Modern, Automated, and Reliable Technology Project that we submitted as an application to Department of Energy's GRIP program. We recently received the very exciting news that we were successful in that application and PUD was awarded one of the 34 projects that were selected for funding in that program, out of a pool of about 350 proposals from across the country. So it was a very competitive process, and I'm very happy that we were selected as winners. We were selected to receive our full request of $30 million from the Department of Energy, which we propose will match with $30 million from Snowpud side. And really, the focus of this grant is to enable us to expand on and accelerate our planned grid resilience and reliability projects from a 20-year project into a very fast 5-year implementation. Some of the goals, if you remember, of this project is to reduce outage restoration times through remote switching capabilities and smart grid programs through our SCADA and ADMS software systems. Another goal is to do some wildfire risk mitigation through some communication and change to our protection strategies, as well as replacement of potential fire sparking fuses in our high wildfire risk areas. And finally, improved grid efficiency through our demand voltage reduction application. The project includes extensive engagement with our communities, regional stakeholders, including IBEW, to ensure that the project benefits are maximized to the communities that need it the most. Update on where we are today. The team has started early contract negotiations with Department of Energy, and they're expected to continue for the next few months. The timeline that DOE has given us is approximately a 4-month timeline for kind of those contract negotiations. I'm here to tell you we will keep you posted on the progress of this project, and we'll provide a full update prior to requesting the commission's review and approval of that final contract. And I just wanted to, you know, say from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much to the huge team that helped get this application across the line, as well as the people that are working right now to, you know, meet with Department of Energy and really kind of get the contract set up. We're super excited and really looking forward to this journey over the next handful of years. So with that, I'll open up to any questions you may have with the caveat that I will probably say a lot of, I don't know.
And I do want to just also acknowledge John, who led the project, Susie Oversby, Boss. Those are three of a lot of folks that were involved. This was a huge, huge lift. I mean, I just cannot emphasize that enough. And Kim Johnson from the ELT was kind of the sponsor of the group. And so kudos to Kim as well. But team just did yeoman's work to get this not just across the finish line, but in a place where, again, as John said, 34 projects out of 350 some. It's a big deal. It's a big deal. And it's a huge deal for our customers. Most important.
Doesn't it also, I thought I read that it reduces the time from 20 years to 10 years.
5 years. From 20 years to 5 years. The planned deployment of these this technology was over a 20-year span. And with the funding, you'll push that down to closer to 5 years. And those are significant benefits, again, to the customers.
So I also read that it's going to take some additional labor, probably with certain kinds of skills, to be able to do this, and probably ongoing because of the technical nature of it, right?
Yep.
Well,
that's
if
right.
I think of it from the, excuse me, sorry about that.
I was, yeah. From the point of view of the grant administrators, I think this is what they were looking for, is a community-based, really on the go, really dedicated, you know, really active public utility. Were they all public utilities? No.
In fact, I don't know what the actual percentage is of who received grants, but my guess is it would be a higher percentage of investor owned. I don't know that for a fact.
Right. Well, then we can find out.
Yeah.
But that's still commendable.
It is. And to your point, Commissioner Wolf, there were a lot of different concepts that DOE wanted in these, and mm-hmm. our team hit on every one at a very high level. It really checked all the boxes and beyond.
Amen. Thank you.
And you know, that's one of the big challenges in writing a grant. I think most people think, oh, it's free money. Well, the money's free, but the staff time and the work and the coordination to make sure that you've answered all those questions and you've made constructed an argument is a tremendous amount of work. So I know it took a lot of time and a lot of staff time. So thank you very much. What a boon for our customers. $30 million to make our system more resilient and more efficient is huge.
And we want to celebrate that. And then it's right back to work. Now the work begins.
Yeah.
So the negotiations will be over the next 4 months. What kinds of things are there to be negotiated? Just timetables and things like that?
Yeah. John, you want to touch on that?
I can touch on that. Yeah. So the big part of the contract negotiations will be establishing the budgets, the timelines, the kind of check-in points with Department of Energy, and what they refer to as their go, no go checkpoints. So we'll have to demonstrate, you know, we'll agree on the key milestones for continued funding throughout the project. And that'll be the bulk. And then verifying that some of the what I would call legalese of make sure that the equipment we purchase is Buy America certified, that type of work over the next handful of months.
Budget. And I just wanted to put another, you mentioned grant writing. That's an art.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
It really is, you know? And that's why I think Sonoma has just been successful, is that our folks have developed the ability to fish in that grant such that it stands out.
Yeah,
right. That isn't art.
Yeah, and it just goes again to
who knows, to everybody that works on it.
Yeah, to the talent that we have.
Mm-hmm.
It goes on display, full display for this. All right. Next up, we actually, Maureen Barnes, who has two presentations this morning. The first one is on surplus and sale of an easement to BPA. And then she'll follow that up with fish habitat property purchase. Good morning, Maureen.
Good morning. Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
So this morning, my first presentation is for an easement to Bonneville Power Administration. There we go. So the purpose of the presentation is to inform the board of an upcoming request to declare surplus a portion of district fee-owned land and allow real estate services to execute an easement with Bonneville. We want to be able to answer any questions regarding the transaction, and we are looking to inform the commission in preparation of holding the public hearing and voting via resolution at the November 21st commission meeting. So back in 2017, and I'm not real positive, I think it was completed actually in 2017, started a little bit earlier, BPA, working with district staff, began improvements to an overhead transmission line, which connected to a new dead-end bay at Beverly Park substation, switching station. And this was a 230 kV line. Construction was completed, though at that time an easement was not executed. The total easement area is approximately 820 feet by 100 feet wide and encompasses about 1.9 acres. Compensation amount is $121,000 and it's determined by an appraisal. Here I just wanted to show some pictures showing that they're not the only one. It's a large swath, but there's multiple lines out there. I believe that it's us, BPA, PSE, and just also the ground is very hilly. You can look and see our switching station, which drops down then catty corner to our another 5 acres that we do own. And the white dashed line is the approximate area of that easement. Here again, drawing. So facts and next steps. BPA equipment has already been installed. At that time, no district equipment, facilities, or access was impacted. We reviewed this and approved the request. Staff and real estate services, also working with legal. November 21st, 2023, we will be back to hold a public hearing and a vote via this resolution. Now I'd like to answer any questions you guys might have.
I have none. Do you have any issues?
Not at this time, no.
I just want to say good catch. Nice to you found it, and I'm pleased that money is flowing the other way from Bonneville. Not a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, move the decimals.
Maybe a bit of a push.
But, you know, that's just, you know, it's a good piece of work. So.
Thank you.
Thank you for your work. Yeah, good job.
Thanks.
Again. Good job again.
Thank you.
Excellent. Right into the next one.
Yeah. All right. So I'm still Maureen Barnes of Real Estate Services. But on this one, I am going to have a co-pilot. So Kyle will step up in just a moment. So the purpose of this presentation is to inform the board of the proposed purchase of 2.83 approximate acres located at 12326 Trout Farm Road in Sultan. Outline the primary terms of the transaction. This transaction will come again before the board via resolution at the November 21st commission meeting. Here I'm going to go ahead and let Kyle jump right in.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Kyle Gerrard, Natural Resources. Wanted to give a little bit of background on the funding and the property itself. So this property will be funded through our Fish and Wildlife Habitat Enhancement Fund. This was created as part of our settlement agreement with the hydroelectric relicensing. is for future activities as determined by the Aquatic Resources Committee. And it's focused on improvement of habitat for habitat is used for Salton River destined fish. And initially, this was seeded with $2.5 million with an annual contribution of $200,000 starting in year 11 through the term of the license. Other detail, our finance department invests fund in interest-bearing accounts, and the Fish and Wildlife Plan identifies a variety of projects, including enhancement, water budget, flow releases, conservation easements, and property acquisition. So we worked with the Aquatic Resources Committee, and they identified and approved this property for acquisition, given that it is immediately adjacent to the Salton River and it has Trout Farm Creek. So the Salton River makes up the western property line, and Trout Farm Creek, which is a tributary to the Salton, makes up or travels north to south through the east portion of the property. The intent, you know, is to restore riparian habitat through a number of activities, and these are going to be determined by the ARC and prioritized by the ARC, along with the associated funding. And this includes removing any existing structures, fencing, septic infrastructure on the site, obtaining any existing water rights claim associated with the property, managing noxious weeds, revegetating the site, and addressing the 33% passable fish barrier, passage barrier, which is via culvert that is under the existing driveway. And there's potential stream channel restoration on site. That site's kind of been hammered through past land use, primarily like probably livestock. And just as a little setting, so the district currently owns approximately 5 acres, two parcels north of this site, and this is where our boat launch is, where we utilize it for monitoring, also for recreation. Kayakers use that for takeout site when we do our whitewater events. And this site's approximately a river mile, 2.8, and it's, I think, 2.8.
So who are we negotiating with? Who are we purchasing from? It's in here, and I just issued it.
I actually don't know. No, that's fine. It's from a private owner. Actually, the gentleman passed away, so it's through his heirs. So what we're looking at on the due diligence on this is that back in July of 2023, we did go ahead and enter into a purchase option to purchase agreement, which that was put in place that allowed us to complete all of our due diligence prior to purchasing the property. All of that has been completed. We had the property inspected by our own environmental affairs, and it was determined to have absolutely no adverse environmental concerns. We did have an appraisal done, and it supports the purchase price of $440,000. I will say that the appraisal did come back higher. Though there is a mobile home on site, which will remain, many of the outbuildings and a lot of garbage has already been removed. We've made option payments in the amount of $25,000, and those will be applied to the purchase price. So our next steps is to seek approval from the commission at the November 21st meeting via resolution to approve the transaction and complete the purchase. Legal staff have reviewed and approved the option agreement as well as this entire transaction, and both real estate services and natural resources have reviewed and approved this acquisition and recommend approval. And I'd like to add that I was actually out during this time with a broken ankle. And it was incredible the way that my staff and Paul just really jumped in and got this done. So big thank you, guys. Now, any questions?
I have one, and it's really, I guess, a question for Kyle. So Kyle, can you tell me about the Aquatic Resource Committee? I had not heard of this. Is it part of the DNR or state or what? Local?
Yeah. So it's made up by both local and state, and they help administer our FERC license. So it's got DOE, City of Everett, Fish and Wildlife, City of Salton. So they all weigh in on implementation of our license. And we meet quarterly.
The tribe also is represented.
Yep. As well.
Great.
I have a couple questions for Commissioner.
I'm done.
Okay. Kyle, I guess we have a question for you here. Looking back at slide 5, the aerial photo, can you sort of show us how the stream goes and does it connect to that Oxbow Lake? Or, and then what kind of work are we going to do along the stream, shading or side channels?
Yeah, so it runs kind of the I would say the northeast corner there is where the culvert goes, and it travels kind of in an easterly direction. It does connect into that old Oxbow,
okay.
And there's probably around 250 acres of like a sub basin up there, and there's, you know, little offshoot tributaries. And then it travels on site directly south, and I'd say the stream channel on site has been hammered. It's got invasives, yellow flag iris, canary grass. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine, you know, as part of our restoration, we'll be controlling noxious weeds, introducing native plants, and, you know, potentially some actual stream channel modification and the removal of that culvert.
Where is it, culvert?
It's right along the south property line. So the existing driveway kind of runs from east to west along the south property line.
So are there other property owners along the stream who are there agencies working with them to help return the stream to more natural condition, or?
Yeah, I think the property to the south has a similar situation with their culvert, the 33% area. So, you know, that's on the radar for local agencies as,
right,
you know, they prioritize their culvert removal, but or upgrades. But.
And lastly, why are we keeping the mobile home?
So we are not keeping the mobile home. Unfortunately, that was one thing that they were not going to remove. It is pretty much permanently set with a deck on it.
Okay.
So that will be up to us to go in at a later date,
okay,
and have that removed. And I did want to add that on our district owned property right up there, that we have done fish enhancement right off of there along the river. And then if you follow south further down, we worked with 3 different property owners to actually put in place conservation easements along one of the
Great.
Tributaries.
Great.
And one of them that we've worked with is Volunteers of America.
Great.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. I have no more questions.
What were the other outbuildings? More trailer?
There, I believe there was an old camper, a number of sheds, kind of lean-tos, and I think even maybe a well shed.
Okay.
But all of those things, septic and well, those will all be decommissioned.
Great. Thank you. Any more questions?
Okay, good. All right. Well,
terrific.
Love seeing you guys. Hopefully not again next month, but we'll just wait and see. Thank you.
Thank you, Maureen. Thank you, Kyle. All right. Next up is an update on our energy storage. And that will be Garrison Marr. Garrison.
Hey, good morning, commissioners. Good morning, everybody. So I'm really excited to give you an update on the energy storage project. And we did kind of lay out the next steps that we were going to take in terms of staff due diligence roughly a year ago. And there is a lot to catch up on. So that's really the purpose of this presentation. It says I'm supported by the energy storage team. I think it would be more fair to describe that as a small army of folks. And I want to take the opportunity. I think this could be fun. Maybe it'll be weird. But if you have attended at least one meeting on the energy storage project, could you stand up briefly if you're in this room? So, but I'm here to tell you that there's.
I can find that way,
yeah.
Sort of awkward, the people that didn't get to stand up.
And to the people who remain seated, let me tell you, there's additional projects that we are looking forward to getting you involved in. But this is just the people in this room. And what I'm hoping to demonstrate by that is it really takes a lot of smart people to work on a project this significant, because we really want to be great stewards of our customers' funds that come in and make smart investments. And so really what you're about to hear is a presentation on what we think would be a smart investment that has had a lot of peer review and a lot of evaluations to make sure that it's prudent. So we'll launch right into what this agenda looks like today. We want to go back and really talk about energy storage need. Why do we need a large battery for the PUD portfolio? You can think about this as sort of the business case. We've got a business case for the Block Slice product, which is a BPA power product that we hold today. We also got feedback from this commission that we wanted to see more information on the business case if we were a BPA load following power customer and what that would look like. So you hear more about that today. I'm going to talk about the development structure that we're proposing to pursue a battery with. It's different than anything that we've used in the past. There's a new market that's developed for this development structure. We want to explain that and talk about how it mitigates some of the PUD's risks. We also want to talk about the procurement path that we've gone on so far. It's a procurement path that is clearly not finished, but it is something that we want to share with you what due diligence has looked like. And then lastly, we'll close with some next steps. What can you expect in the fourth quarter of 2024? So today, no decisions need to be made. This is just informational, but this is preparing the commission for when we do have an executable energy storage agreement that we believe we are likely to have this quarter. So questions are welcome. That is kind of the scope of what we'll talk about today. So we'll launch right into it. Some of this is refresher. There's some updates here as well. The energy storage need, or you could also consider this the business case for the battery project. One thing to think about is our IRPs, or these integrated resource plans, essentially are business cases for resource acquisitions in the study context that they're from. So 2021, we did an IRP. We assumed the Block Slice product. That IRP found a need for about 70 megawatts of storage, really to augment the capacity of our portfolio, give us a greater ability to integrate renewables, a lot of which come overnight, right? Winds blow in, rivers are running, that sort of thing, and redeploy it during times when our customers have higher peak demands. So that was 2021. That's what we found. That really launched action plan, which was adopted, that said staff really needs to do due diligence on what the best technology looks like. And so over a 6-month period, largely with our friends in the generation department, we looked at a number of different technologies that we could pursue. Pump storage, hydro, liquid air or cryogenic storage, and lithium ion batteries. As we looked at those options, thinking about the capital expenditure needs, what we would use the battery for, kind of what the best overall value was, we really zeroed in on lithium ion batteries as being kind of the most cost effective choice. That launched the rest of the due diligence process, which I'll describe in the course of this presentation, to see what the market had, the different ways we could structure a battery development, and what that overall value looks like. So that's where we were in the 2021 IRP. I believe it was last Monday, we released the 2023 IRP update. And that IRP update did assume that we would continue the course on the 25 megawatt battery. And it also essentially found, you know, the 70-ish megawatt threshold that the 2021 IRP had found. So here we've got total of 75 megawatts of storage. The 2021 IRP found 70 megawatts of storage needed, so really confirming that storage need in this IRP, which again is sort of the Block Slice outlook business case.
So Garrison, it's not a coincidence that I assume that in 2027, when the battery is that wedge is there for the battery, that our market purchases drop to zero. And this is the pathway to that goal.
That's correct. And, you know, these are forward purchases. We'll always have some volume of balancing purchases, right? But really, as we're able to bring on physical supply side resources, like new renewables, like the storage, and make continued investments in conservation, then we can step back from some of those planned forward market purchases.
Thank you.
And that's where we're trying to get. So to say this, you know, maybe in a more concise way, if we look at the BPA lock slice product, if we're that type of customer in the future in this post-2028 contract, we have essentially two business cases that say we need storage that results in the lowest cost to serve our customers. We got the feedback from this commission that we should also be looking at the load following product, and we would use a battery a little bit different in that case. So I want to talk about how we would use the battery in either situation. On the left hand side is block slice, on the right hand side is load following, and then I'll show you some more data about that. But for the block slice, it really is, as I described earlier, integrating renewables, that clean, flexible capacity. It also will contribute to our RAP requirements, RAP being the Western Resource Adequacy Program. So we get about 85% nameplate credit for the battery, which will significantly help with compliance there. Will help us manage our transmission congestion risks, right? We have a portfolio of transmission, but it's pretty fixed on a long-term basis. Having some in-service territory, storage and generation helps with that. And then also, as we move towards an organized market, some benefits as it relates to bidding in load and mitigating some of our congestion pricing risk that gets baked into an organized market. So that's sort of the elements of value that we get as block slice customers.
So with regard to the RAP, does just having the battery help us with the RAP requirement, or do we have to utilize the battery in a certain manner to get that advantage?
It's both. The RAP has two requirements. It has a forward showing requirement, which is 7 months before a season, you need to demonstrate that you have adequate capacity. And so we would help there, right? On paper, we would have the battery,
right.
85% of nameplate helps there. In the operational period, all of that capacity becomes shareable capacity, right? If there's a regional loss of load event or a blackout risk somewhere, then we can be called on to deploy it to aid our neighbors the same way that they would be called on to aid us if needed. And so it would be something that would be part of all of our resource portfolio that we would make available to really help the region.
But we would know in advance what it might be called on. So it's not like we have to leave it in a charged state in case there's a, that's what I was getting at.
Yeah, we'd know in advance and we'd also be compensated.
Yeah.
So that's block slice. The load following side looks different. As a load following customer, Bonneville is essentially meeting our load. And what the battery would do is help reduce our bills of Bonneville meeting our load. There's a couple different ways this works, but in the load following product today, we have a demand charge, which is our peak demand. That would be a significant portion of our overall bill as load following customers. And it would directly reduce that, right? We would use the battery to reduce those peaks. The other element relevant to the battery is load following customers is the load shaping charges. Load shaping charges are essentially the difference between our load profile and what the federal system can do. And it is priced at a forecast market price for on-peak energy and off-peak energy. Off-peak energy being cheaper, on-peak energy being more expensive. We would essentially charge off-peak when it's less expensive, dispatch on-peak where our peak occurs, reducing our on-peak load shaping charges. So those two elements is where we would get sort of EPA monthly bill relief if we were to have this battery. And it would also reduce sort of our peak supply concentration. What I mean by that is, and I'll show you a graph of this too to make it, you know, a little bit more visual, is if you're a load following customer, you will have significant peak load service needs that we would put largely all on Bonneville. And whatever happens with peak load pricing will be a significant element of our overall power supply cost. So it might be wise to diversify some portion of that cost concentration. And I'll show you what that looks like in the next slide. But beyond just the known billing determinant pieces here, there's also a risk mitigation and diversification element that's worth thinking about, even if it's a little qualitative.
It also seems like that with the battery, block slices, some of this risk, inherent risk, which we know there's lots of inherent benefits too, but it seems like it does help mitigate the market exposure risk.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So these are the bullet points. Here's the math. So in the 2023 IRP, we developed a whole new computational model to take a look on a forecast basis, what our peak loads, our energy, sort of load profile would look like, and what our forecast BPA rates would look like. You've got two graphs on the left. One is today's BPA rates escalated for inflation, and I should mention normal-ish inflation, right? So a 2.5% rate of inflation. That's the left-hand side, right? Those are lower. So here we're looking at a little less than $4 million in cost savings per year, up to about $5 million per year, right? This is just the BPA cost savings. This does not include the cost of the battery yet, right? So we're just looking at what's the value that we would get as load-following customers. The right-hand side prices capacity at the marginal cost of capacity, which is not reflected in current rates, but we have expectations that in this provider of choice post-2028 contract process, they will be moving closer to those marginal capacity cost rates. The actual truth of it is unknown at this point in November 2023, but we're really confident that that number is somewhere between the graph on the left and the graph on the right. So what's important is that the cost of the battery also be at worst, right, between the graph on the left and the graph on the right. And that is our expectation there. So you can see that most of the cost savings come from reduction in demand charges, and a smaller portion of those cost savings come from load shaping charges. If the market for wholesale electricity increases, that slice of the pie will increase as well on the load shaping charge, but these are pretty modest forecasts for market prices. Right hand side, just taking a look at how much of our peak demand would be priced as meeting a demand charge under a BPA load following product. And so you can see it's depending on the month between about 200 and 600 roughly today, increasing to between 400 and call it 1,000 megawatts depending on the month in the future. So 25 megawatts is not a lot, but it does mitigate a little bit this real significant cost concentration in BPA serving a pretty big portion of peak demand. Just something to think about as well.
Thank you, that's helpful.
We'll be able to talk kind of in general terms about the cost profile for the battery today and in specific terms later as we continue to negotiate this ESA. But this is a really relevant price point for us and something that we're thinking about very hard. So that's the need and the use cases. Let's talk about the development structure. In the past, we have used external funding largely to fund development of batteries that we essentially took on a lot of responsibility for development, operations, all of those sorts of things. We wanted to look at something different at this scale of procurement, which is 25 megawatts, to see what the market would bear. I'll talk a little bit more about how we did that, but first I want to talk about the energy storage agreement structure that we are pursuing, and really how that works and how it's different. So I'm going to move around these rectangles here. So I'm going to start with the top left-hand corner, which is the basic premise and structuring of an ESA. Here, we, the buyer, Snohomish PUD, enters into a performance-based contract, really just for capacity, as it is available from the battery at defined performance specifications on a monthly basis. So what I mean by defined performance specifications is we want a 25 megawatt battery. So if it's not 25 megawatts, there is a reduction in payment for that. We need it to also be a very efficient battery. So if it's less than 85% return trip efficiency, which is the industry standard, then we need to have a reduction in cost for that as well. So it's performance-based. We measure these things. We pay based on the performance of the battery as it's available to us to meet our needs. The second bullet, up row in the middle there, is that rather than us taking on the responsibility to fund development, the seller takes on all responsibility for building the battery, for operating the battery, and eventually at the end of its life, decommissioning and safely removing that battery. So all of those risks become the seller's risks, not the PUD or the buyer's risks.
So how do we coordinate operating the battery? So we have a specific need for the battery to do something, but they're operating it. How does that coordination work?
So here, think of operating it as sort of like a, repairing as needed, making sure that it's functioning perfectly. Batteries have HVAC systems, for instance, right? So is the HVAC system working great? That's different than scheduling and dispatching and charging. All of those functions we would have sole control over, subject to some contractual rules that we all agree on.
And this is dedicated to Snohomish only.
You're the only contractually allowable offtaker user of the battery.
Yep.
On the right-hand side, you mentioned this before, we only pay based on that available capacity, but also if this battery does not meet its defined performance standards, we actually could receive some payment to compensate for that. So there's a little bit of teeth to the performance standards that make sure that we're getting a high functioning asset. The bottom left hand side is the form of the payment, right? So assuming that the battery works perfectly, what does that payment look like? Does it change over time? No, it doesn't. It's fixed rate, right? Fixed rate capacity. We know how much we'll pay over the 25 year asset life in the first year of the asset. That's important because, as you all know, the wholesale electricity market changes dramatically year to year. And we expect, with inflation and other things going on, that some of the capacity products in the future will be subject to inflation over time. This locks in a fixed price at the beginning. The last box there.
Excuse me, before you go to the last box. So the seller accesses defined payment stream. Does that mean a separate system would be hired to do the payment stream?
No, I think this is really the what's in it for them part of the equation. So for them, right, the counterparty or the seller, they know that they also have a fixed payment coming on a monthly basis if they perform how they expect to perform over a 25-year term. So that's attractive to them because there's a lot of certainty. They're not subject, right, to a volatile wholesale electricity market either. So it's mutually beneficial in that sense, as long as that fixed rate for available capacity is at the price point we need it to be for the two different use cases that we just talked about. We need it to work well for load following customers or for block slice customers.
I think the word access is just was kind of threw me.
Yeah.
So they I think it's a good word. Just have.
Okay. Maybe you'll get to the complete failure of the battery. Is that all working in terms of into the, a contract like that, where we feel that the battery is not performing as we need?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what happens?
Yeah, so it's all measured, right? And if the battery's not performing, we don't pay. That's the first thing that happens, right? And then there are also some remedies depending on what part of the development cycle we're in, where we can access some defined securities to offset costs related to that failure.
We're not really accepting any risk. It's all on the owner of the battery, or?
There's no such thing as a risk-free project. That would probably be fair to say. This is a development structure that deliberately mitigates the overwhelming majority of the risk.
Yeah.
This will still be a project that's on our site.
Sure.
This is still a project that we'll be very invested in and performing well. But we don't have personal responsibility for the types of kind of performance risks that we're really thinking about here.
So is there going to be a container that's going to hold a number of batteries, or one enormous battery?
Yeah, so it would likely be 1.48 acres of very many battery containers.
Oh, yeah. 1.48 acres.
1.48 acres, yeah. So, you know, which sounds like a lot, but, you know, it's not quite a football field, I think, if that head map is about right.
Hearing about storage containers for storage that can be driven places, you know, to different locations, maybe utility or business.
Yeah, this will not be that.
Okay.
This will be fixed in place,
okay, well,
long-term assets.
Okay. Now this, I apologize if this is, so this doesn't require expanding the wind farm. Okay.
No, but this will be standalone energy
storage.
Okay. Yep. It'll connect to the grid, and what we hope is the region puts plenty of wind into the regional grid, pushing down prices that allow us to access those low wholesale electricity prices at the hours that it's cheapest, to save it for the times that it's most valuable.
It's kind of comparable to pump storage concept, isn't it?
Yep, same concept. So last box on the right, we're really looking at kind of what is the structuring that could be most cost effective for the PUD over the long term. We have, through an RFI process, determined that having defined standards for a 20-year period, that helps us meet our needs, spread out costs so that our annual costs are low. But at the end of 20 years, we still expect the asset to have remaining useful life, because they've had to meet those high performance standard across that term. So we want to be able to access that useful life as well. So extending the term an additional 5 years, but dropping performance standards for the last five is the most cost effective way in our analysis to access the battery.
So you're saying fixed costs for the term of the agreement. It's fixed. There's no 5-year check-in.
That's right.
Okay.
It's fixed, but it's performance based.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. So if performance is 90%, then our costs are 90% of the fixed costs.
Who decides when it's time to decommission it? So is it automatic that we can go 20 plus 5 years? Or is the battery still performing well? Can we go 5 more or 2 more? How did that work out?
Contractually, we'll be in it with the counterparty for 25 years, just like anything else, just with some of our other agreements. You know, if there is an opportunity that both parties are excited about, we could extend additionally if the data on the ground warrants that.
And is there provisions if the entity bankrupt or out of business?
You took the word out of my mouth.
Yes, the contract will address those circumstances. It is one of the things that we need to be thinking about really hard. But it'll address that. It's probably also worth mentioning, this will be a battery located on our property, charged with our electricity. We're the sole off-taker. It's not going to have a crazy amount of value to any third parties, even through a bankruptcy proceeding, if one were to occur, because it is bolted to the ground in a specific spot. So, it was a lot on how an ESA works, and I apologize. Wanted to give just a quick example of the differences between an ESA and what it would look like if the PUD were to build. And this is just, you know, one is intended to correspond with one on the other side, just to give a sense of what the differences would look like. ESA. Payment based on performance. Payments are spread out on a monthly basis across a 25-year term, right? So a lower upfront financial impact to the district. PUD builds, costs are all due upfront, right? We need to pay for that full development cost, order the materials, all of those things. Now, PUD, if we were to build it, we may be able to build it for cheaper than under this structure, but one of the things we're looking at here is the cost-risk trade-offs, and this is the structure that we're looking at for this battery. Number two, and under ESA, the counterparty develops, maintains the battery based on performance specs. So if we were to build, right, we would perform or contract for that maintenance and operations. So that's another difference. Number three, if the battery underperforms, we actually would be eligible for payments from the seller to compensate for that underperformance. Number three, on the build side, if that were to occur, we would have to address that, right? Maybe there's warranties, but absent that, that would be on us. Number four, counterparty accesses tax credits. Those get baked into the contract price, pushing it lower, right? If we were to build, we would need to access those tax credits, and we would need to provide all the tax credit accounting and the IRS auditing, looking for Angela Johnston's facial expression from our great finance team. We think that it's attractive that we don't necessarily have to do that in this structuring, and just something to share. Last, counterparty would be responsible for resource decommissioning and removal at the end of the useful life under an ESA. If we were to build, right, we're responsible for that, whatever the laws are at that time for recycling or disposing of components, that would be on us. So that's another risk mitigation step that we get in an ESA.
It seems like a good way to leverage our staff. That's an organization who does this, do it, and then frees us up to something else. We're doing another one of these. It seems like it makes it less onerous.
We think that this is a good structure, especially with the tax credit opportunities out there right now, to access this new part of the battery market.
Let's say it was underperforming. Do we then go to the market? Is that what would we have to do?
Likely, yeah. Okay. Yeah, we would, and that's really what that compensation is intended to provide
okay.
for.
Yeah, okay. And without giving utilities, which what example of this structure has been used elsewhere?
That's a good question. I don't have specific utility names at hand. I can find
those. I'm not asking for that. I'm just asking in terms of, is this a new concept, or is this, has this been used elsewhere?
I think SMUD has, some storage projects.
Yeah, but with this particular structure, I mean,
yeah, we'll talk about it in a future slide,
it would be interesting. I think
let's move on then. Yeah. I don't want to hold it.
No, I think it would be interesting for us to see what's already been done and how it's working. And so I do have a question about relating to number five on the PUDs. What is the status of the previous storage efforts that makes that projects? Have they been decommissioned? Are they being removed?
So do you want me to?
Well, the one is.
I would encourage us to, maybe we could go back to that in a future briefing, because I think we'd probably spend a good amount of time talking through all the projects.
Keep us in line.
I would really like to know about that at some point.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, keep in mind, those were R&D projects, and we've given a number of updates on the latest one, the microgrid. And we can bring a refresher if the board desires, but that's really kind of off topic from what we're focused on here. So if the board is interested, we can provide an update on our existing battery projects, including the microgrid. But again, this is really focused on a different.
Well, it was a long, painful thought. If that's been taken care of, hasn't it? So in terms of decommissioning.
Yes.
I don't need an update.
I would either be up and read multiple times.
My apologies if it's off topic. I thought it was related, so.
Yeah.
Well, it is definitely a good way to make sure that all the best information is delivered. I know that I'm over time budget here a little bit.
Well,
so
sorry about that, but you do have an engaged board.
I love
that's
it.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. So we've talked about ESA structures, sort of what they are, how they're different from previous structures we've used to develop batteries. Want to also call out that the ESA structure also enables us to specify safety performance standards as well. So performance, right? Performance-based payment aligns our incentives, both us and our counterparty, right? If anything happens with the battery, then they don't get paid. Right, and in fact, that they wind up paying us. And so they have a strong incentive to keep that battery safe, high performing, because in many cases, we expect that they'll need to borrow significant money to develop the battery itself, right? So they have other pressure on them to keep this working well. We also will require this and have required this to meet all the latest codes and standards. You've got a couple of them listed here. So we're really making sure that the battery that gets developed is meeting all of those most stringent standards. I do understand that there was a question from this commission about a recent incident in Idaho battery project. And in researching that as staff, we don't have all the information yet. They're still doing an investigation on what caused that and what could have been done to mitigate that. We do understand that it was before the battery was ever commissioned and going live, so it was something that happened early.
Was this
process.
A Vista?
I think this was.
Oh, don't say anything.
Yeah.
It was in the press.
Further east.
Sorry about that. That didn't happen.
So we can provide more information at a later date, but I do understand there was that interest and wanted to provide that info.
And I did check with my fellow commissioners and John. Is my request for just a few examples of where this concept has been used, so we're not treading the new territory here.
Yeah, and I'll show you the process that we used to establish that this was not, you know, an exotic concept, but we can come back with specific examples too.
Then as we move forward, my request goes under the table.
Well, let's come back to it and make sure that I can address.
I think this concept is used with other technologies for all kinds of companies where you don't own a piece of equipment.
Oh, yeah, the output of
wind
farms and that sort of thing. I just
you've contractually acquired it.
Right, but I'd like to know where this particular structure
right.
concept. I know that these kinds of things are used throughout the industry for.
It's similar to a purchase power agreement.
Yeah.
This has some additional, I'll say, different dynamics. Battery's going to be located on our property and so forth. But we're happy to research other other agreements like this.
Well, I would think that's been done by your.
I think it's a good question when they come back to us with something.
Okay, all right. Drop the ask.
So
I'm not asking anymore.
So I wonder, Harrison, should you mention about SoundGrid Partners? Looking at the industry and say something about that.
Definitely do it.
So just closing out, what is an ESA? What does it do for us? How's it different? Just want to make sure that we're all on the same page that a very important part of this is safety, the safety standards that will be required, and also we've got aligned incentives here to make sure that this battery works great, otherwise counterparty doesn't get paid.
Well, especially since we've done so much work to make our batteries some of the safest in the country, we put all this work into, so you would want this battery to be suboptimal fire engines.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a lot cool, but not as good.
So that's really what we're asking for in this ESA. I want to talk a little bit about the process that we use to get there. I think this gets Commissioner Olson to your question, as well as references what Scott just mentioned. And
I just want to drop my request.
Yeah.
Okay.
So our specific ask in a battery ESA, 25 megawatt battery, 100 megawatt hours of storage, 85% return trip efficiency. Those are our performance standards, right? 20-year term with defined performance, and then, like we mentioned before, 5 years with capacity as available. We envision this as storage capacity expansion. The Arlington microgrid campus, where there is an available 1.48 acres to connect with the PUD built substation that is an acceleration of a substation already identified to serve growing loads in North County. And then we would also require the counterparty to decommission and remove the battery at the end of the useful life. So that's the what specifically. We got there with this process. We started with a request for information that went out across the country. We actually got responses from across North America to that RFI. We asked for an ESA structure and a traditional build structure. So we had an idea of what price impacts and market depth looked like. We felt pretty comfortable. There wasn't a huge material price impact, and there was sufficient depth of market go to the next step, which was an RFP, which was released February 2023. We received quite a few offers there. I believe the number is six, but I'm nervous to be quoted on six. Just a good number of offers out there. And then we evaluated them as a large team. Many of the folks that stood up earlier to select a couple finalists and receive best and final offers, where we're really looking at that fixed contract price along a standardized term sheet. Through that process, we selected our preferred partner. We have been negotiating with that partner from July to as recently as this morning on the final terms and conditions at that fixed contract price. And that is what we are working to bring to this commission. It is an executable ESA in the fourth quarter of 2023. We know that we are looking at a price point. It's really price sensitive, right? Because we were looking at those load following graphs earlier. That's not a big spread. So we know we have to really hit that number, and we have to hit the performance standards for RAP. And we know we have to hit the safety standards at the highest level So that's really where we're at. What we've been pushing for, we think will be significantly under the cost estimate provided to this commission last year, which is a very positive thing. We're, say, in the ninth inning in this negotiation, and we're going well. And that's why we felt comfortable providing this briefing at this time to make sure that the commission had kind of the fullest update in a sense of where things were going next.
And there'll be more briefings, right? I mean, this is the procurement process, and then you go into the actual planning process, right?
Yeah, I think at this
point, I'm talking about, you know, coming online, and this is premature to ask that question.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, we're still working towards that executable ESA, and we know that there will be a need for making sure that this commission has the transparency it needs to.
Oh, no, yeah, but I, 4 years, five, I don't, what would be a realistic, when we can turn the switch on and use it?
Well, let's talk about that. So if we were to execute this ESA in the fourth quarter of 2023, we anticipate that we can this battery be online October 1st, 2025.
Okay.
That is a magic date in some respect. In the provider of choice contract discussion, any resources that were online before this date could have been treated as specified resources that could have reduced capacity allocations on this specific date, or date thereafter would not do that. So there's a really specific reason that we're targeting this date, which is the earliest date that we would like this battery, unless something changes in the provider of choice framework. So we're right on schedule with where we'd like to be. We think that we've got a great structure. We think that we have a good price point. We're happy with the counterparty. We're working on the final terms and conditions. We expect to come back to y'all in the fourth quarter.
Thank you. John, should we take a 5-minute break before we do the final?
I've got some comments.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
You mean?
Do you have any questions or comments?
No, I don't.
I beg your pardon, sir.
And my apologies for this is fascinating.
Yeah, I just have a few comments. First of all, great presentation. Thank you so much. I'm impressed at the 85% efficiency. I think I might exceed my courage. And thank you so much for helping me understand the business case and looking at load following. I also realize, and I apologize because I've really sort of pushed what's a business case. When I was thinking of business case, I was thinking of a project like ConnectUp, right, which is a completely discretionary project that relies on its economics alone. And I realize this is just like building a substation, right? It's a piece of equipment we need, operator system. We identified that need in the IRP, so it helps me. But it helps me understand, you know, we don't know what our future is going to be with our contract, so it's very helpful. Thank you.
So 1 megawatt hour. Let's see, 1 megawatt provides, help me out here, 330 homes for 1 hour.
650. Scott is saying 650.
650.
I think in general terms, we've been thinking about this project is sufficient to power a decent sized town for 4 hours by itself. It's just sort of a benchmark for what it can do for us.
Okay, I've got to go back and do my math. Thank you. Okay, we'll take a break until about, let's just say 10:25, okay? CEO, General Manager, will continue with the load forecast.
Yes, next up is our 2024 LoadFed forecast. It's Felician. Morning, Felician.
Morning. Hi, I'm Felician Eng, and I'm an economist here in the Rates Department, and I'm here to talk to you about our 2024 load forecast.
Lucian, can you get a little closer to your mic?
Yes, I will.
Maybe up your call, so.
All right,
there you go.
Is that better? Okay. All right, the purpose of this presentation is just to update the board on the latest long-term load forecast. It usually feeds into our IRP, budget process, and our cost of service. There's no expectation coming out of this presentation. It is purely informational. The agenda for today was we'll start with a little bit of our economic environment that we're currently in, and then we'll go through our sector forecast for residential, commercial, and industrial. So starting off with population, the current population of Snohomish County is about 848,000 people. Last year in 2022, the county added about 12,500 people, which comes out to roughly about 1.5% growth, which is a pretty healthy rebound from the prior year, 2021, where we only saw a 0.8% of growth. Migration continues to be the main contributor to our growth, accounting for roughly 75% of it. Meanwhile, birth rates are continuing to fall in in our region. In fact, I read that the Washington State birth rate has fallen 22% over the last 15 years. So migration has definitely made up the difference there. The county, as far as for the future goes, is still expected to reach about 1.1 million people by 2044. We are forecasting a slightly stronger growth in the near term, about 1.5% annual growth over the next 5 years. And in the long term, following that, it's about 1.2% annual growth, which is pretty on par with what we've seen pre-COVID. As far as the current labor market conditions, the Snohomish County unemployment rate was 3.6% in September. And we've been pretty much trending around that range of 3% range. In fact, even in 2022, we were already in that 3 to 3.5% range. So we've been going along there. The labor force participation rate is pretty strong at 67%. So a high labor force participation rate means that a good portion of our working age population is either working or looking for work, which is a really good sign for the economy. And just to add a little bit of context to that, we ended 2022 with a participation rate of 64.5%. So we've been kind of increasing that rate throughout the year. If you recall, last year we were talking about the Great Resignation and the labor shortages that we were facing during that time. That's when we saw the job opening rate, which is the gray line on the chart you see here, rise all through 2021 and 2022. That has since began to come down a bit, and the gap between the hiring rates and the separation rate has been closing in lately. So with the good, you know, unemployment rates and the stable hiring and separation rate, we are looking at a much healthier labor market. Looking at where unemployment rate has been and the outlook of it, in the solid blue bars, we have the historical unemployment rates, and the forecast is in the dashed bars. So economists in our regions are forecasting that the unemployment will settle around the 3 to 3.5% range again, which is where we've been and where we have been prior to COVID. So again, another good sign of the labor market stabilizing. Inflation continues to be a topic of interest. Last year, we experienced some of the highest inflation of our times. We peaked in the summer of 2022 with an interest rate of 9.1%. As you can see from the graph on the upper left, that has since began to cool down to 3.7%. It's still it's doing pretty good, but still above the Fed's target of 2% inflation rate. For the Seattle metro area, we continue to exceed the national average. It was last recorded that we have inflation around 4%. A lot of that is attributed to cost of shelter, which you can see, you know, home prices have been pretty resilient despite the really high interest rates that we've seen lately. In order to bring that inflation down, the Fed has put in a lot of effort through a series of rate hikes that began in early 2022, including four that happened just this year in 23. The last one was in July, which was 25 basis point increase, bringing our current Fed rate to 5.25% and 5.5%. There's only one, not two, remaining Fed meeting left in 2023. They just met last week, and the committee has decided to leave the rates unchanged once more, at least for now. So the reason, part of the reason why inflation has been so persistent and stubborn through Fed's effort is partly due to consumer spending. Here on a chart, we have U.S. retail and sales as a change from early 2020. And as you can see, post-pandemic, that spending really jumped up and never came back down from there. So despite, you know, the high inflation and the high interest rates, the consumer kept on spending and spending, which really has kept us from falling into a recession and also has kept inflation down. Another sign of high spending is credit card debt. U.S. credit card debt reached an all-time high this past summer to $1 trillion. Usually during high interest rate period, the spending is supposed to slow down because we're rewarding savers, but we haven't quite seen that. So, you know, even though borrowing money costs more, consumers are just keep on spending. Another interesting note is that we saw that American aged 65 and up accounted for 22% of spending last year. And that has been steadily going up throughout the year, as you can see the red line on the chart. The retirees, you know, they did get a bit of a pay bump this year. You know, Social Security benefit rose by 9%, I believe, in January. So I'm sure that has contributed to some of the extra spending that we're seeing. But on the flip side, our younger age group, the 25 to 34 years old, we saw a bit of a decrease on their debt. So that's a good reminder to us that inflation can impact different age group, different income levels very differently, depending on what your basket of goods consists of.
How do they determine what people over 65 spend? I mean, I would think a lot of that would be for travel, but how's that fact?
I'm sure there is some sort of, you know, either
who says that?
This is from the data from the Labor Department.
Labor Department. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think with the older age group there, that they are living longer, they are living a better quality of life. Yeah, so there's more traveling. I'm sure during there was less spending to happen during COVID, so there's a bit of savings involved as well. So there's definitely. Even during the inflation period, you know, the younger age group usually they spend, or the lower income groups usually spend more of their income on things like shelter. You can imagine if you're maybe more stable income, already have a home, maybe you don't have to worry so much about, you know, mortgages or rent. So you have more disposable income to spend on.
Yeah. Okay, so it probably wouldn't include like purchases of new homes.
I mean, it could include in that, but it's probably not as big of a portion.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's a fact.
It's interesting that the 65-year-olds and older are more optimistic.
But she mentioned typically when you get there, you own your home.
Yeah.
You have, typically, the seniors plus,
yeah,
you own your home, and you have planned. Those that have planned well for their retirement just have more disposable money that they can spend. I was surprised at this too. This kind of, so I thought about it.
The two of you are like on a spending spree.
I know, yeah.
I'm going to pretend I didn't hear that.
Oh, la la. Okay, thank you. Another little distraction, but you know, it really caught my attention because I'm in that.
As far as what we can expect for future inflation, we can look at the tip spread. The tip spread is the difference in return between the treasury bond and the treasury protected inflation protected securities. It is basically the market expectation of inflation. And if the spread is wide, that means investors are thinking that the inflation are going to rise. And if the spread is narrow, then we can expect inflation to be stagnant. And as you can see historically, that spread has been around 1.7%. It did widen last year when we were having really high inflation to 3%. And now that things have cooled down just a bit, the current market expectation is around 2%, which is what the Fed is targeting. Now taking a look at what a return to work is looking like, on the left, we have a split of companies' policy around work location. So what we're seeing is more and more companies, in fact, 60% of them are offering some sort of hybrid work policy, meaning requiring workers to come in a few days a week, but not 100% of the time. And on the right, we have the rate of office occupancy in the 10 largest US metro area. And what this chart is telling us is that about 50% of the workers currently are going into the office during the week. The Seattle area falls somewhere close to the average, maybe a few percentage point lower. So I would estimate around 45 to 47% or so. But in general, the average in-office days is about 2.5 days per week, with Tuesdays being the most popular day, and then Wednesdays and Thursdays following that. So this continues to be something that we will continue to monitor because it does affect the energy consumption pattern during the week for us, and as well as overall consumption.
I was talking to one commissioner whose PUD has come to a 4-10 program, 4 days, 10 hours, and they love it. But it's a different PUD. They don't have electricity. They have other things. They have water and, you know, and water. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know that it would work for us, but maybe that's, yeah, that's, it was interesting, 4-10, yeah. 4 days, 3 days off.
The crews have occasionally over the years been there, or are they on 4-10s now?
We have some crews, substation crews primarily work 4-10s.
Oh, they do?
Yeah. Line department does not, unless it's a special work situation or a special project, they can vary those hours. Still on.
Yeah. I think the idea is that not everybody's going back 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in terms of load for us, that does impact us because we see people going into work, but as well staying home, right? In their homes.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Just like that.
Electric vehicles. So last year we introduced a pretty significant increase to our EV forecast, and here's a chart showing how many vehicles we've added into the county by year. So far in 2022, we've added about 500 new EVs, and if we continue at that pace, we could expect close to 6,000 EVs by the end of 2023. That's about 40 to 45 year-over-year growth, which actually was quite on track with what we were forecasting. And here's a reminder of what our electric vehicle forecast looks like. Hasn't changed much from last year. We're still estimating roughly 700,000 vehicles by 2040. That includes both plug-in hybrids and battery electric vehicle. And by that time, in 2040, EVs will account for roughly 60% of the vehicles on the road.
60%,
yeah. So after we introduced this forecast last year, we walked away with some homework, basically asking us to help identify where exactly within the county we think these EVs are going to show up. So which brings me to this slide. And on the map on the left is we have mapped out the propensity level or the likelihood of an average resident purchasing an EV. Here, we for the visuals, we have it organized by zip code. And the way we figure these propensity level is by taking everything that we know about the customer, such as the type of home they live in, the type of heat they're using, are they owners or renters, do they currently have solar, do they already have an EV. And then we also have some marketing data about them, which tells us what type of consumer they have, but they are, whether they're early adopter kinds or they're wait and see. So all of those are based on you know, their education and income levels, their age groups, and hospital sizes, etc. So taking all of these data together, we were able to make pretty reasonable estimates, such as that a South Bothell resident, for example, is 2.5 times more likely to buy an EV over someone living in Arlington. Even within each of the cities, we'll have different propensity levels. So, you know, somebody living in the south end of Everett has higher propensity than somebody in the north end of Everett. The map on the right is what we get when we apply these propensity level to the population. So for this particular map, it's for 2040, when the region should be well saturated with EVs, and it tells us the number of vehicles that we think is going to show up in each of those areas. So the bigger the bubble size, that means the higher number of vehicles are going to be there. And even though, you know, the propensity level for somebody living in Arlington is pretty similar to someone living in Darrington, we still expect more vehicles in Arlington just based on the fact that it's a more populated area. So the results of the study really give us a much better idea of where we think these EVs are going to pop up. Like I said, you know, we, for this purpose of the presentation, we have it by zip code, but we actually have the data to be able to view it by substation and even go down to the feeder circuit level. So we really have the ability now to kind of drill down and see where our problem areas are. Yeah, I think they have a pretty high propensity. I think maybe it has to do with the demographics that's living in Hyde Island. And, you know, by 2040, we do expect a lot of EVs in the county. So. Moving on to new housing stock. So we're still seeing some changes there. And on the left is the type of homes that we are seeing more in. On the left is what we are seeing, the type of home that we see more and more. So in the past, whenever we had new housing, they were predominantly new single family homes. 2 years ago, we were estimating that 63% of our new premises would be houses, but now that our area is becoming more dense, we're seeing a shift towards a more multifamily homes. So in our forecast, our ratio for apartment buildings, for example, is increasing from 25% from 2 years ago to now 47%. On the right is the type of heat that we are seeing in our new single family homes. So the green portions in the bar shows the amount of electric heated homes that we're seeing currently. So as you can see from 2019 to 2021, about 25 to 30% of the new single family homes were electric. But in 2022, that jumped to about 40%. So new building codes were introduced that year for large multifamily homes, with the idea that that eventually would carry through to new single family homes as well. And that actually did happen just this past summer. So we were already kind of seeing in the data that there was a shift happening, and that shift is going to continue to happen. So we've made the adjustments in our forecast to reflect that.
I'm actually surprised that the number of single family homes is that high for 2020. To drive around, all I see is multi-family. So I'm curious what our projection is. Is our projection pretty aggressive as far as multi-family growing over the next several years?
Yeah, so we have, well, right now, you know, your single family home, you know, has fallen from 63 to 42.
Right.
So that's quite of a big shift.
Pretty rapid, yeah.
Yeah, even just in 2 years.
Yeah.
And while apartment buildings, and that's just apartment buildings that we're seeing in these numbers, there's also townhomes that I'm not sure we're there, and duplexes and such.
Is anybody wondering about not new homes, but transitioning from gas to electric?
Not new homes. So we do actually, I was going to talk about that, we do have an assumption that this is going to happen slowly, but over time it will happen.
Mm-hmm.
That is going to be in our forecast.
Yeah, it's happening.
So speaking of our forecasts, we'll go through each of our individual sector forecasts. So starting with residential, you see here in the solid blue line is our historical load. The dashed blue is our current forecast, and the dotted gray line is our forecast from last year. So overall, we're looking at about a 2 to 3% increase over last year. Some of that is driven by new housing that we are expecting due to the higher population forecast that we mentioned earlier. With more people, we can also expect a few more EVs on the road. And then there's also an increase in the expectation that new homes now are going to be electric going forward. And on top of that, such as we just talked about, is the assumption that some of our old currently non-electric homes are going to begin to convert slowly over years, the next 20 years.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I had not remembered. I looked at this, 30%.
30%
looking at over the next 20 years.
Yeah.
So, thoughts on why we're dropping from our historical for the previous year? Is that just the weather?
Oh yes, because every time we when you forecast, we do normalization of the,
okay.
We start from normal weather.
Gotcha.
On the commercial side, things are staying pretty stable, about 1 to 1.5% increase over last year. Again, our commercial new premises is tied to our population forecast, so we're gonna expect a little bit of an increase from there. And we're also adding a little bit to our electrification of commercial vehicles in the county. And finally, whenever we hear from our new accounts groups of any new larger commercial load coming online, we add that to the forecast as well. On the industrial side, so what you're seeing here is the change from Boeing's announcements of them bringing the 737 MAX assembly line to the Everett plants in the second half of 2024. So we've always had, you know, that load coming back from the vacated 787 line, coming back into the forecast, but this just kind of shifts things, the timeline a little bit. But one thing that you are not seeing here on the slide, that didn't make it on the slide, is something we just heard last week, Friday afternoon, is that the recycling plant that was expected to come online in 2026 is actually pulling out. So we will not be seeing that bump up in 2026. In fact, that blue line should be coming down about 12 megawatts or so. So we should be more along in that 100,000 megawatt hour range from what you're seeing here. So a bit of surprising and unfortunate news coming from there. But putting it all together, we get the full forecast with the historical going all the way back to 1969, and the dotted line again is our previous forecast from last year. So overall, we're looking at roughly about 1.5% of increase, and that is including the adjustments from the industrial we just talked about. And finally, this last chart summarizes all the driving factors that are impacting our load forecast. So anything above the zero axis line is an addition to our forecast, and anything below is a reduction. So some of the big ticket items that is contributing to the increase is population growth, of course, and as well as the electric vehicles that you see in the light blue. Things that are helping us keep our forecast down is energy efficiency, codes and standards, and a little bit coming from rooftop solar and climate change. But on the net, as you can see in that dotted line going across, we do expect our forecast to be growing over time. And that is it for my slides.
That's fabulous. Great information.
Just one quick comment. She had hit on the recycling plant that we had while we were coming to the area, actually up by Arlington. The latest intel suggests that they are still going to potentially locate a plant in the county, but only do a certain portion of the process, and anticipated potential load of about 5 megawatts. So it's not all lost, at least the most recent intel that we've got from that.
You said anticipated 12, so that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, 12 and actually growing, I believe. Potentially. But yeah, they pulled that off the table and they're going to go into the route.
you think, well, it's possible some other company could want to come in and do a recycle.
Yeah, I think this is a specific type of recycling, and they have, I don't know if they have a patent, but they have, the process that they have is kind of their own, and they just pull that off the table.
I saw on the program last night that in England, there's a company that's recycling clothing. And they're saying they're recycling so much clothing. They got an award from Prince Charles. Who's the king now? Charles. King Charles. Anyway, they said that there are enough clothes already in the world to clothe everybody from now on with the recycling clothing. Maybe it's a new fiber, it's a new business. They're kind of recycling, but interesting.
Fascinating forecast. Thank you for showing us this economic indicator.
Yeah.
You know, it underscores my concern about building apartments and an electric grid business heating, which is what they tend to do. So that's a lot of load that potentially is unnecessary.
Well, I attended a program over the weekend. It was on Saturday, and it was about flood risks. Mostly Skagit County, but we have a lot of flood risk to it. I don't understand how so many multiplexes are being built in these lowlands. But anyway, that's another topic. But I do wonder about that. We are at great risk for floods.
Thank you, Felician. Excellent job. That is for the presentations this morning.
Well, it was quite an interesting morning, and let's see, it is now 10:53. The meeting is recessed. The regular meeting will reconvene here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m. Thank you very much.